full hour to discuss this topic with us. This will be Tal Manville. He presently is a teacher over at the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. He's also a captain, United States Navy retired, with some great experience in our carrier force. Tal, welcome to MidRats.
Good evening. Great to be here.
And thanks again for coming on this Sunday and giving us an hour of your time. And I'm going to kind of put you on the spot a little bit here because I know nobody likes to toot their own horn. But you aren't just another generic retired Navy captain with a little bit of time on aircraft carriers. And just so our listeners can kind of get a view of the perspective you have and the level of experience of aircraft carriers that you bring to the conversation, if you could, for the listeners, just take a couple minutes and describe for us your background in aircraft carriers and some of the projects that you've worked on recently.
Well, I started serving on aircraft carriers in August of 1973, where I was on the John F. Kennedy, where I qualified as a EEOW and as an officer of the deck, participated in I was in the middle of their nine-month deployment where we supported Israel in the Yom Kippur War. Got to see some pretty interesting things like many nuclear weapons put on the flight deck for possible use one evening in October of 1973. Also, on the second deployment, was involved heavily in the firefighting efforts after we collided with the Belknap on November 22nd, 1975. That date is etched in my head. Then went on after my first tour and after becoming an engineering duty officer, then assisted in the supervision of the construction of Carl Vinson and Teddy Roosevelt. Spent 3 years there really learning my craft as an engineer. And then after that, I went to the USS Midway as MPA, where we steamed a lot out of in my 33-month tour, steamed 27 months out of 33 months on Midway, took on Oppie and passed Oppie and got the first perfect score. As a snipe down there in the holes, I was very proud of the troops, my troops. And in 1994, we got the first perfect score of a ship in the Pacific Fleet. After that, came back and taught, and then returned to sea as chief engineer on America, where made three deployments, and one included Desert Storm. Then went back to the NAVC aircraft carrier office, led the development of the incremental maintenance plan for the Nimitz class. Then got put over to the Pentagon, was first the shipbuilding assistant for Admiral Joe Lopez in N8. I was special assistant for shipbuilding and engineering, and then got pushed down the hall to be the executive assistant naval aide to the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, John Douglas. Then my last 4 years in the Navy, last four and a half, I was the first program manager for future carriers, and where we looked at 76 different designs and eventually went to the Ford class and got the Ford class approved for 12 carriers for the aircraft carrier for the first part of the 21st century. So that's about it.
Well, that's an impressive resume. Let's talk a little bit about the future of aircraft carriers. There seems to be a momentum building. Maybe it's only among the Marines, but for using smaller flight decks, the LHAs and similar smaller flight decks for carrier-type operations using short takeoff and landing or vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, what advantages of a large deck?
Well, a large deck allows you to launch and recover CTOL aircraft, where the energy system that is required to launch the aircraft and recover them are on the large ship. And what basically that does, that doubles the range and doubles the payload of any strike fighter aircraft, and it also provides you with the E-2s and the growlers that you wouldn't have on the LHAs. So with a CTOL, So with a conventional takeoff and landing, you have all the fixed wing aircraft at your disposal. You can have the S-3s if we had to bring them back for anti-submarine and anti-surface ship warfare. You have the growlers, prowlers for suppression of enemy air defenses. And you have obviously the E-2 for the surveillance. Those are not possible on the smaller deck. Now, one of the interesting things in the design of the studies we looked at in the Ford, we also looked at to try to combine. And one of the things we found that if we had a large deck aircraft carrier, where on the bow, where you could put a ski jump, either articulated that could be moved up or down, you could do STOVL aircraft forward on a large deck aircraft carrier, and you could still do CTOL aft. Naval aviation, the naval aviators were not interested in that solution, but that solution was possible. We presented that as one of the studies. I thought that would have much more fetch because you can see that as the budget crunch comes and we're trying to put aircraft to sea, that putting a combined STOVL and CTOL aircraft could be a winner. And you could do that on a large deck, but you certainly couldn't do that on a small deck.
Tal, let's pull the thread on that a little bit, because when you look at the LHA and the LHDs, they're essentially roughly the same size as a World War II Essex-class aircraft carrier. And when you look at some of our allies' light carriers, they're even larger than that. And with the possible utility, assuming that it comes online, of the F-35 Bravo, that they're a very flexible platform. Obviously, it's not a light carrier, but it has some characteristics of it. And to spread your eggs around the multiple baskets, which in a few vignettes would be very smart to do, but there is something that you mentioned there, whether it's parochialism or politics or concern for funding lines, there's a lot of pushback in the naval aviation community from being able to fully get the flexibility out of those platforms. How do you see that ability with the F-35, especially coming online, of, if needed, even with the pushback we have, of being able to take advantage of that flexibility and have, in addition to our big decks, our LHAs and LHDs functioning in a few vignettes and scenarios in a light carrier type of scenario?
Well, how much in a light carrier type scenario? I mean, one of the things. I mean, how many F-35Bs do you think could go on? Let's say, like the LHA-8, the America.
I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, I have heard two squadrons. And one of the things recently, I was involved in a study where I was consulting with RAND, and we went up and we were looking at the small carrier. RAND was asked to look at us. To do a small carrier study. And one of the things we looked at with the LHA, and we were also looking at a Marish converted container ship as well. And one of the things we found out is that you can't get two squadrons of F-35Bs on board, primarily because they're having problems with weight, and they have pushed some of the things like air conditioning unit that could be run, that's required if you want to do maintenance on board the ship, that you would run if it was installed underneath the dash panel of the aircraft inside it. They put it off, so they have expanded the amount of yellow gear. And so, I mean, one of the things we saw was that trying to put F-35Bs because of their weight problems that they're having, that they are proliferating the number of tractors that have air conditioning systems and power systems that they need, that you don't see that on like the F-18E and F. The biggest thing, the biggest drawback that I learned about in doing the studies of looking at STOVL versus CTOL is that because you have to put the energy system to launch and recover on the airplane, STOVL aircraft have half the range, basically half the range, half the payload. And so when you talk about the flexibility they have, that basically, you know, when you compare that to a CTOL aircraft, what I came away with was, why would you handicap yourself with airplanes that have half the range, half the payload? And so that is the big argument. That is the big argument. And so the argument that the Marines say, well, it can press on land and then, you know, hop further forward if you have forward stations on the land and also prosecute the war. However, did we do that in Iraq? And the answer is no, because we had plenty of land bases where we also were able to have, we were also to persecute, or not persecute, prosecute the land invasion, for instance, in Desert Storm with land-based attack aircraft as well as the aircraft carrier attack aircraft. So we didn't see this what I would call base puddle jumping of the Harriers during Desert Storm. So they had a very limited role. So I don't, you know, when I hear this flexibility about the F-35B, I'm a little bit, as compared to what? To the greater range and capability of the CTOL aircraft? That's where I see, where I don't see the F-35B, or, you know, a STOVL aircraft providing this greater flexibility. Now, the argument is, but you can have smaller, you can have more of the smaller carriers. One of the interesting things that occurred during the debates where during the Carter administration, was looking to cancel the Teddy Roosevelt and replace it with a CVV, which was a small carrier alternative. And one of the things that was asked by the Navy were saying, well, if in fact you find the CVV satisfactory, are you going to build twice as many of them? And the answer was no. So the idea, if you're going to replace a big deck with a small deck, typically because they are very robust ships, and they are far more robust than the LHAs, because the LHAs are not as survivable as a robust CBN that has armor, underbottom protection, side protection. The argument is, are you really going to buy twice as much? But even if you do, with the F-35, with a strike package, let's say that you can get 24 F-35Bs on board, which I doubt you can. I think it's more the numbers between 15 and 18. But be that as it may, can you still do all the warfare things like, you know, ASUW, AEW? And the answer is no. The answer is no. So it's not a same trade, even if you have two or three LHA-8s with their strike package and or V-22s, you still need the CVN there. So it isn't a one or another. It isn't one or another. Now, if you get in a situation, I mean, one of the things we looked at was, I mean, during this time, we went back and looked at World War II. When were the small carriers? As I remember my math, we had 24 large decks, counting all the S classes, large decks back then, versus about 110 small deck carriers, Jeep carriers, and my father served on one, the Sergeant Bay. And when you looked at them, you saw that in many cases they were truly just, in many cases, such as my father's ship, he spent most of the time ferrying airplanes from islands to help the island hopping campaign of the Pacific. when they did get into combat, we lost one large deck carrier, but we lost 10 small carriers. And survivability is a big issue. The LHA-8 is not a robust, survivable ship as compared to the CVN. So, yeah. Take it back from there. Any questions on that?
Yeah, it's amazing when we have amphibious ships that are a little tender like that. You mentioned something really interesting, because I know when you got started compared to when I got started in my naval career, I mean, you saw this in a lot better depth than I do, because I saw it wind down. But it used to be, and this is one of the critiques that you hear recently, it used to be the depth and the range of your strike package was very important. And what we saw at the end of the Cold War, we saw the death of the A6, and then we have most recently seen the death of the F-14 and the non-parasitic, which is what I call, using the strike fighter as a tanker, non-parasitic organic tanking capability. So we have our large deck carriers that without the support of land-based U.S. Air Force-type tanking, the argument is made that we have a smaller strike package with shorter legs requiring us to get closer to where we need to go. And that runs into the face of the continuing to evolve threat globally of the anti-access, anti-denial weapons. Do we have ways that we have systems or programs in place to address that, or is this really an overblown concern compared to what the capability and the range we used to have with our strike packages?
Well, I think that is an issue. I mean, one of the things that they do like is that they want the tankers to be as fast as the strike fighters. So, you know, one of the things you say, well, can't we use S3s as tankers? And the problem is that they can't roll in as fast. So but the capability of using strike fighters in a tanking role is that they can't put, you know, as much gas in the air as you would have back in, you know, and I think that they don't have the capability that the A6s had, because they were also designed for their, you know, the alpha strikes, where they had a whole bunch of ordnance hanging under their wings. And so they were able to fly more gas. But the idea, though, but that kind of argues then that you want to put more strike fighters, or, you know, more those that are going to be tanker duty on board the ship. And once again, the big deck gives you that flexibility that you wouldn't have otherwise. And you can, you know, virtually overnight, you can roll those airplanes in. If in fact you need to do, you know, a double hop where you're doing something on the order of what you're doing in Afghanistan. I can remember that our largest or our longest strike package or range that we analyzed for the studies for OSD was something on the order of 500 miles, and they kind of considered that absurd because they said, why do you need to go more than 500 miles? And so we never in fact exercised ourselves with some of those scenarios. We basically concentrated, there were basically two scenarios, standalone Falklands type of scenario where you're up against a second-tiered country that has a fairly robust air threat, like Argentina, like what the British had in the Falklands. And what we found out, or at least what I found out was the lack of a E2, of being able to see the air picture, was a real detriment to the British in the Falklands. The second thing they learned, and one of the things that we learned in the strategy was, or in the AOA, the analysis of alternatives for the CVN-21 or CVX, was that we had to come up with a critical capability. This is one of the things that's defined by the 5000 series. Before Rumsfeld, it was called the mission need statement. After Rumsfeld, it was called the critical capability. Whatever you call it, it basically says, what is the key feature that you want to build into the thing that you're buying? And for the aircraft carrier, it was this. The critical capability or the mission need statement was defined as, for the aircraft carrier, that its aircraft must simultaneously perform for extended periods of time, independent of land bases, surveillance, battle space dominance, and strike. And one of the things that we learned was, what I learned was, and then it was broken up that we had 40 aircraft air wings, 60 aircraft air wings, and 80. And so 40 aircraft, basically you have there, you have basically 40 strike fighters, and then you have 40, you have basically then with CTOL, you have the Growler, and you have the Growler did we put on the air wing, and I don't remember, and we had the S-3s, and then we had, but then we, well, basically it comes down to 20 support aircraft to support surveillance and basically picking up pilots with air, with helicopters, and then you had 20 strike fighters. You then basically have the same number of support aircraft for strike when you have a 60 air wing, but now the number of strike fighters goes from 20 to 40. And then when you go to an 80 aircraft wing, you basically have like 30 support aircraft, and then the rest, the 50, is for in the strike fighter role. And what we learned there was that in the Falklands scenario, a small air wing of 40 aircraft that includes its own E-2 and its own Growlers for suppression of enemy air defenses, that you could only, that the an Argentinian or some of the more robust Arab states that have a pretty good air force would put a small carrier completely on the defensive, and so it could do no strike. And so as we were going forward with this, we said the small air wing and the small aircraft carrier should be put aside. And it took us 9 months to get that decision from OSD, and then we concentrated on the large and medium aircraft carrier. And the big insight occurred there was we said, okay. And then OSD kind of defined to say, okay, exercise yourself in the most stressful environment, and we see it as a Persian Gulf scenario where there is no aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf. Some hostile regime goes down both sides of the Persian Gulf, sees it, mines the Straits of Hormuz, and now the aircraft carriers have to fight their way in and fight and win. And so they then said you're going to have four medium aircraft carriers with 55 on their decks on the ship, and then the large aircraft carriers, four of those at 75. And so we looked at that scenario where on day one there's no aircraft carrier there. Day seven, the first one shows up. Day 14, the second one shows up. Day 21, and then day 28. And then we started looking at the scenario of what targets, and there was this wargaming tool that Lockheed Martin had that was called Thunder. We had to spend nearly $1 million using this tool to go look at this scenario because they had all the targets of all the Persian Gulf area, and we looked at that, and the bottom line was that the big decks in that scenario could generate, they basically generated 16,000 sorties, of which 8,000 were strikes. And the medium deck generated 4,000. The medium-deck aircraft carriers were robust aircraft carriers that had side protection. They had the catapults. They had all the robust auxiliary system, which makes aircraft carriers expensive. When we looked at the difference in performance, it was 100%, 4,000 versus 8,000. When we looked at the difference in cost between the platforms, the medium-deck aircraft carriers were only 8% less. When you also then put in the air wing, the air wings, when you put in their total cost, now these are very big numbers, you know, obviously in the billions, the total cost between medium versus large was 13%, but you got basically 100% more performance out of large versus small. Then the person from OSD who was out of the PA&E shop challenged us and said, "Don't you guys understand this problem here? You know, we realize that it's not the aircraft carrier cost that's the problem; it's the airplanes." And we kind of anticipated that. And one of the things that we did was that in that Persian Gulf scenario, we took the medium air wing and put it on the large deck. And the thing that we learned was, and I was surprised; I did not know that this would happen, that we would get 5,600 sorties of taking that 55 aircraft air wing and put it on the big deck, and you got a 40% improvement just by changing the platform. Now, why is that? Well, the larger platform doesn't have to go alongside, come offline from its strike mission in order to refuel and rearm. And also because it had one more set of elevators and a four versus three shaft propulsion system, it was more reliable there. And it also could fly more in heavy weather. They're basically mediums, and this is like a size of a midway class, can fly 60-65% of the time in the Arabian Gulf through all 12 months, but this scenario was only 28, so that didn't really come into play, so I'll pull back on that. The size didn't really matter in terms of weather, although it does matter. But there was the big epiphany, and so what OSD learned was that if you have a stable set of platforms out there that can have as many as 80, you don't necessarily have to populate it with all those expensive airplanes if, in fact, the budget drives it down and the threat is less. And that's almost exactly kind of how the Navy has managed itself the last 10 to 15 years. It's going to sea with far less than the number of airplanes it can take to sea on the big decks. But what they learned was you don't design the aircraft carrier for the optimum number of airplanes because of the flexibility that's built into it. And we learned that when we put that medium air wing on that large deck and got a 40% improvement, and we had to prove that. They were all from Missouri on that one. They said, "Show me," and we did, and we showed them. And basically the opposition to the big deck in OSD at that time, and there was strong opposition to it, they just folded their tent and said, you know, we see the logic of buying a large platform but not necessarily populating with all the airplanes.
Tal, we have Jerry on the line with a question. Jerry, you have a question for Tal.
Yeah, I think it goes to the question of the current investment decisions we're making with regard to large deck aircraft carriers. Specifically, is the premium that we're paying for going from the Nimitz class to the Ford class going to be worth it in the sense that we're making a significant investment to increase sortie generation with EMALs on the Fords, but we're paying a tremendous upfront premium to pay for that technology, and it doesn't look like platform cost is going to come down across the life of that particular platform. So, for instance, right now with the Nimitz, we're getting about 140 sorties per 24-hour period, and they're promising us a 20% increase on that with the Fords, and yet we're going from about $7.4 billion per copy to $12.4 billion. seem to be upside down in this investment?
Well, if you were just looking at sorties, you may say, you know, and if that's the big measure, that would hold. But quite frankly, I mean, one of the things that we showed was, in fact, that the Ford class, and this was, and this is well after I was out of the Navy, but I was privy to this analysis. Actually, the Ford class cost just the same as the last Nimitz class, as the Bush class. Now, part of the problem was what drives the cost of ships is, in fact, the fact that OSD and the Department of Defense delays these construction things. We were ready to go to construction, to a construction contract initially when we first started the study, when we, in 2000, when it was agreed to that we were going to build a big deck nuke that is the Ford in 2003. That got deferred to 2004, 2005, and then eventually we got a contract at the end of 07. That causes, I would argue, the delay in making those decisions and stringing these things out is probably the biggest reason why we have these costs. That would still be that cost that you quoted, the 12 billion dollars. I think you were also including the non-recurring costs of the new design that's being applied to all the carriers. If you were to put the Bush in the then-year dollars, it would cost more than the Ford. Okay, and so. In trying to do the apples-to-apples comparison, the Ford basically costs as much as a Nimitz class, but we have made significant reductions in the total overall costs. For instance, one of the things that was a strategy that naval reactors embraced was to reduce the number of things in the propulsion plant. On the Nimitz class has over 1,200 main steam valves. On the Ford class, it has less than 200, a 6-to-1 reduction. They've also made a similar reduction in the number of watchstanders, which causes the Ford class. So once that ship gets to sea, even though it's an enormously costly, its overall life cycle costs are about 20 to 25% less than the Nimitz class, because we're leveraging off of the Nimitz class. I mean, basically, the Ford is a Nimitz hull, but with a lot of changes. I mean, one of the things we also did was to reduce the number of topside tractors, yellow gear, that we need in order to do that. We got the island out of the way. One of the things we found out about the island on the Nimitz class is it's located between L2 and L3, right where the planes want to roll out. And one of the things we learned was if we move the island, I myself wanted it moved forward, but if we moved it aft, which is where it wound up, that the airplanes can taxi and the number of aircraft handlers and yellow gear that we have to have up the flight deck are a lot less. Also, this idea of sorties. The sortie thing, I think, is, in terms of numbers, even though it's a key performance parameter, that I think that the need for more sorties is kind of mitigated by the smart weapons technology, where you don't need as many sorties as you needed in the past, because now one airplane load can take out two or three targets, where before you needed many more aircraft to take out one target. So the smart weapons technology kind of decreases the need for the increase in sortie generation rate. But EMALS provides it. But what also EMALS provides is that we're going to be able to dial in smaller unmanned aircraft that can go on that a steam catapult can't be dialed down to. That's one of the big things about the flexibility of EMALS, is that you're going to be able to shoot off smaller platforms, unmanned platforms primarily, that couldn't be done on a Nimitz class with steam catapults. There's also tremendous survivability improvements in getting rid of steam around the ship. We have gone to all electric, and with the all electric catapults, but also steam heating around the ship. So if in fact we have some type of disaster like we've had in the past in the Vietnam Wars, where we have flight deck catastrophes where, you know, bombs are going off in the flight deck and then fuel spilling down around the ship, ship is much more survivable because it isn't going to be able to find hot surfaces to ignite that fuel. And we've also made a tremendous improvement in the ordnance handling, where there will be no bomb farm around the island where that ordnance will be exposed to the hazards of the flight operations on the flight deck. What they have done, they've expanded the sponsons, that part of the decks between the forward starboard elevator and the second elevator that's in front of the island, okay? Those two areas that are in sponson areas that are hang out from the hull, underneath that area is where we're going to have our ready service magazines. And that's going to provide a tremendous increase in survivability that we don't have on the Nimitz class. So that was done by my successor, Captain Dudley Berthold, and his team, and an ordnance team that did a tremendous improvement on the weapons handling inside the ship. So that is one of the things that we have done. Where I think that the Ford is very much worth the investment over the Nimitz class.
Ready.
Jerry, did you have a follow-on?
I do have some questions as to the numbers so far vis-a-vis looking back and forth at Ford and Bush, because I've sat and crunched those numbers inside the building, and I don't get them to match in the way that they're described. I don't doubt your sincerity. I'm just saying that based upon the analysis that I'm looking at presently, you know, we're seeing the Bush come in at about 7.6 to 7.8. We're seeing the Ford come back in at 12.4, and we're actually seeing the price on the second hull of the Ford class is going up. And so far as sortie generation, I mean, that is the prime reason for the cited for the investment in R&D for emails is increasing the sortie rate. And I agree with you, in the sense that I don't think that there is a requirement now for the sortie rates that we're seeing. And so far as once with precision-guided weapons, and not to mention with us being pushed back by some of the new anti-access area-denied technologies, we're not going to see that many sorties per day. We're going to see a lot of tankers launch with their aircraft, buddy tanking stores out and back. And I don't think that we can stand on the suggestion that we need email so that we can launch UAVs. Quite frankly, there's any other platform in the fleet that I could go with UAVs on. But if I could circle back on one additional thing that you did point out, and that goes to the anti-access area denial, can we really, I mean, the price is coming in at 12-plus billion, which is our average shipbuilding investment per year has been about 12.8 to 13.5. Can we really afford to risk an entire year's worth of ship procurement in one battle? Has the cost of the platform exceeded the risk that we can accept?
Thanks for the follow-on there, Jerry. Tal, do you have a response?
Well, I wanted to ask Jerry if that $12 billion, that seems awfully large. Does that include the non-recurring costs? Is he still on the line?
Yes. And, yes, the non-recurring R&D that's supposedly spread across the class, which right now we're rating across five ships. Yes, that's them.
Right? Okay.
And
so you're applying that doesn't get applied to the Bush class.
No,
I mean to the George Bush.
Yeah, the emails right. Investment R&D does not get applied to Bush.
Right, and emails has turned out to be. You know, we didn't price that puppy out very well. The vendor that was picked needed more. He got a hell of a lot more money, but I think it's more like $9 billion. But still, that's a hell of a lot of money, and it's and if your figures are correct, then it's more than the Bush. I was privy to this debate where in 2005 there was a very strong debate where the Navy had to show the costs in the same dollars, and in fact for the procurement for the Ford, as it was presented to me, it was a little bit less than the CVN-77, then this is back in 2005, in 2005 dollars, and back then those costs were something on the order of $6 billion back in 2005, so when they were making that comparison. I have not kept up with this recent cost, but the answer is it depends what the nation needs. I mean, one of the things that occurred, should we spend all that money 1 year on a carrier? Poof. Well, remember, not all that money, I mean, what's also occurring is all that money isn't going into a, it's being spread across now 6 years. So in fact, the SCN account isn't eaten up by the carrier by the fact that it's able to be spread over, unlike other ships. It's being able to spread over, right now it's 4 years, and in fact there's an initiative right now by Sean Stackley to get 6-year money, so that the SCN for one ship is spread over 6 years to mitigate that impact on the SCN account. So that's one way to get around the big cost. But to get a big deck nuke, it's going to cost a lot of money. You're right about that, and so one of the ways to mitigate that is to have it spread over, not come just in 1 year, but over 6 years. And in fact, that is happening, and that's one of the significant achievements that that was occurred with the previous CNOs and stuff, because for years, for decades, even Admiral Rickover could not get that to happen, and then my successor Dudley Berthold pulled that off, where he got it spread over 4 years. So the idea that that the CVN, that the Ford is going to eat up all of the SCN money in that year isn't true. It's going to be spread over 4 to 6 years.
Eagle One.
Well, speaking of high ticket items, some of the pressure seems to be, or a question, I know you addressed this in your Next Generation Aircraft Carrier article and proceedings back in, I guess it was October, or June of last year, I guess. Why nukes? Why should we keep nuclear-powered aircraft carrier? What are the advantages?
Right off the bat, you automatically double the amount of fuel that you have on board for the air wing. For that first important arrival at a scene of a crisis, where in fact, so that is the big kind of the tactical advantage that you get out of a nuclear power plant. Plus the fact that in this time where fossil fuels are going up, nuclear power over the life cycle is going to cost less than the fuel bill over 50 years in this time where fossil fuel costs are going to skyrocket. Basically, what we've learned, what we have learned is that if the price of a barrel of oil is over $125 a barrel, a ship that is at 80,000 tons or more, it is more cost efficient to be nuclear powered than fossil fueled. And I think we're going to see $150 a barrel oil in our not too far future. I'm hearing, I don't know if you've been hearing the reports, it's going to go, it may spike unusually high next year because of some problem of production and that OPEC's going back. That tends to change, but in fact, I think nuclear power provides it. Plus the fact that you get the fuel all up front for 25 years, and you can steam many times around the world before you have to refuel. So that's one of the advantages. It reduces your It reduces your need of your logistics trail, and it provides tremendous flexibility. Also, having been chief engineer on a non-nuclear ship, we could not kick it in the ass the way they could. They could go faster. I remember one time we dragged raced with the Eisenhower, and we got up to a pretty good speed, but then the reliability of the Eisenhower's plant overtook us. We were out ahead of them for about 38 minutes. I remember going up to the bridge and watching the FBF, and then we started. Our reliability of our system wasn't as good as the Eisenhower, and we had to back off. We got up pretty high. I was impressed. I was pleased with my guys. We got up to about, well over 30 knots. But eventually the Eye came up and overtook us, and in this hour drag race, they were faster. And the America was with the hull that was lighter scantlings, but it was basically the Enterprise hull, which is probably the best aircraft carrier hull ever designed. I've seen Eisenhower on a radar scope in the Philippine Sea at 38 knots launching downwind, and I was the MPA on Midway, and the skipper turned to me and said, MPA, I want to do that too. I want to launch downwind too. And I said, sir, the best I can do is to get 12 boilers up, or all we're going to do is 31 knots for you, sir. You aren't going to be able to launch downwind. And Enterprise was able to do that day. That was pretty impressive. So nuclear power provides... And not only that, but the other thing I would also argue is that the level of excellence that naval reactors applies to the propulsion plane is second to none. You get the best engineers in the world working on the propulsion plane, which is the most expensive part of any ship. And you get the best engineers, and they have done a magnificent job on the Ford, as they have. One of the things I'm proudest about the Ford class is that it's going to be the first propulsion plant that, besides submarines, that's going to be engineered. In fact, the propulsion plant is a third generation submarine propulsion plant. There's no DFT, which, I've recently saw an article about your first class in college. What was that about? And a lot of people can remember that, and I can remember mine. It was introduction to naval engineering. What's a DFT? And so I learned all about a DFT, and we're not putting them on the Ford class because submarines don't have DFTs, and they have a very deep hop well. It's still a steam cycle, but they don't have a DFT. And so we have the best engineers who work under the high standards that Admiral Rickover set that have provided. And so I would also add that level of excellence pays off also in that. And I think we will get the best propulsion plant you've ever seen.
Yeah, I remember one of my great young memories is sitting there nuking my way across the Atlantic on the Enterprise and looking over and going, we're going how fast? It's impressive what they can do when they need to get someplace quick that really nobody else can get. We were talking about carrier design and really, we talk and boxing above your weight. The Royal Navy has such a great history of innovation in carrier air, whether you're talking about the angled flight deck or so many other inventions.
The hurricane bow, yeah.
Exactly. Now, what are your thoughts about their design for the Queen Elizabeth II class? First thing that pops when I see are the two islands, but have you heard or discussed any of the aspects of that class of aircraft carrier you think is unique or useful or just interesting?
Well, the two island thing, I argued for that for us because one of the things the EMOs complain about is that the islands on aircraft carriers are too small to provide the physical separation to reduce the interference between the radars and the communication systems. And we took that, and we were arguing, uh, we were